for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In the restless imagination of a sleepless widower, the September 11th attacks never happened. But the United States is at war, not in Iraq, but in a bloody civil conflict that's taken 13 million lives. Paul Auster's latest novel explores the stories people indulge and those they can't bear to face. Paul Auster joins me in the studio. His new book is titled Man in the Dark. We do invite you to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Paul, it's good to see you.
Hi, Diane. It's good to be back.
Are you an insomniac?
No. I sometimes delay going to sleep, but once my head hits the pillow, I'm gone.
All right. I don't usually do this, but I'd really like for you to read for us right from the start of the book so our listeners will have a sense of how this moves.
Okay, I'll read the first four paragraphs of the book.
All right.
Here we go.
Okay.
I am alone in the dark, turning the world around in my head as I struggle through another bout of insomnia, another white night in the great American wilderness. Upstairs, my daughter and granddaughter are asleep in their bedrooms, each one alone as well. The 47-year-old Miriam, my only child, who has slept alone for the past 5 years, and the 23-year-old Katya, Miriam's only child, who used to sleep with a young man named Titus Small. But Titus is dead now, and Katya sleeps alone with her broken heart. Bright light, then darkness, sun pouring down from all corners of the sky, followed by the black of night, the silent stars, the wind stirring in the branches. Such is the routine. I've been living in this house for more than a year now, ever since they released me from the hospital. Miriam insisted that I come here, and at first it was just the two of us, along with a day nurse who looked after me when Miriam was off at work. Then, 3 months later, the roof fell in on Katya, and she dropped out of film school in New York and came home to live with her mother in Vermont. His parents named him after Rembrandt's son, the little boy of the paintings, the golden-haired child in the red hat, the daydreaming pupil puzzling over his lessons, the little boy who turned into a young man ravaged by illness and who died in his 20s, just as Katya's Titus did. It's a doomed name, a name that should be banned from circulation forever. I think about Titus's death often, the horrifying story of that death, the images of that death, the pulverizing consequences of that death on my grieving granddaughter. But I don't want to go there now. I can't go there now. I have to push it as far away from me as possible. The night is still young, and as I lie here in bed looking up into the darkness, a darkness so black that the ceiling is invisible, I begin to remember the story I started last night. That's what I do when sleep refuses to come. I lie in bed and tell myself stories. They might not add up to much, but as long as I'm inside them, they prevent me from thinking about the things I would prefer to forget. Concentration can be a problem, however, and more often than not, my mind eventually drifts away from the story I'm trying to tell to the things I don't want to think about. There's nothing to be done. I fail again and again, fail more often than I succeed, but that doesn't mean I don't give it my best effort. I put him in a hole. That felt like a good start, a promising way to get things going. Put a sleeping man in a hole and then see what happens when he wakes up and tries to crawl out. I'm talking about a deep hole in the ground, 9 or 10 feet deep, dug in such a way as to form a perfect circle, with sheer inner walls of dense, tightly packed earth, so hard that the surfaces have the texture of baked clay, perhaps even glass. In other words, the man in the hole will be unable to extricate himself from the hole once he opens his eyes, unless he is equipped with a set of mountaineering tools, a hammer and metal spikes, for example, or a rope to lasso a neighboring tree. But this man has no tools, and once he regains consciousness, he will quickly understand the nature of his predicament.
Paul Auster reading from his brand new book. It's titled Man in the Dark. Paul, I read those paragraphs and I was there.
Good.
I was in that hole and thinking about the man who's thinking about putting that man in the hole. And that is our protagonist, August Brill. How has Brill been hurt?
Well, Brill, he's 72. He's a retired book critic, somebody who wrote book reviews all his life. His wife has died about a year ago, year and a half ago.
And he's suffering.
And he's suffering. He's in a lot of pain. And he had a car accident and has hurt his leg, one of his legs, very badly. And so his daughter, his grown-up 40-something-year-old daughter, who's
Marianne,
a professor, has invited him to live with her in Vermont. And now Katya, the granddaughter, has gone through this terrible experience, and she's there too, and the three of them inhabit this house.
How do you compare August Brill's reasons for inventing this story of the man in the hole with your own for writing this book?
Well, this is a very good question. I think of this story. Brill spins out a number of stories during the course of the book, but the longest one is the one about the man in the hole, which takes up a sizable chunk of the novel. And it is about this parallel world in which America is fighting a civil war, initiated by the 2000 elections, by the way. This is the cause. And I have to say that in my own case, those elections, the presidential elections of 2000, were one of the most shocking events in American history for me, one of the most terrible things I've ever witnessed. And in my view, Al Gore was elected president. And the Republicans, through political and legal maneuvering, stole the election. It was a kind of legal coup, I guess you could call it. And it's been such a source of frustration for me. And I've had this sense that the past 8 years we've been living in a parallel world, that we're not in reality anymore. Reality is that Al Gore is finishing his second term. There's no war in Iraq. And 9/11 might well never have happened. And I think this sense of what's happened to America in the last 8 years, I've projected onto Brill, my character. But in his case, it's a little more somber even than my own, because he's a man in torment. And I think the darkness of the story he invents is a reflection of his psychological state as well. So you read it in two ways.
I've just finished watching the HBO movie Recount.
Oh, I saw that too, yes.
And you bring that to mind as you speak. I think that the idea, however, of parallel worlds goes much beyond that, in the sense that there are those philosophers, and you talk about one in the book, who does argue that the world we're living in may not be necessarily the only
right
reality.
Well, you're referring to Giordano Bruno, an amazingly brilliant man who lived in the time of Shakespeare. He's a late 16th century Italian thinker. And Bruno argued, and it's quite logical, I would think. He said, if God is infinite, therefore, it seems that God's powers are infinite, and therefore there should be an infinite number of worlds. Now, this was heresy at the time, and he was burned at the stake for these ideas. But there is a certain logic, or as my character said, if you believe in God, yes. And I think most of us do feel that there are other worlds out there. We can't be alone in the universe. I don't think people feel this anymore. So the story that Brill invents, or one of the stories, spins out from this idea of the multiplicity of universes, that minds can create universes, whether they're deities or even human beings spinning out ideas that create alternate realities.
Do you believe in God?
No. I mean, that's the short answer. I do know that I didn't create the world. I do know that men didn't create the world. What that force is, I don't know what to call it, the transcendent force of the universe. There is something beyond us, of course. It's just that I don't walk around thinking that there's an intelligence that created this consciously and that he's listening to my thoughts or I can talk to him.
But what you are delving into in this novel is the idea that as we are here, you and I, in this studio in Washington, D.C., we may not be the only reality.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly possible. I don't want to sound like a mystic here or a crackpot, but there's just so much we don't understand about the world, and who am I to presume that I have answers? This book, too, is about other things as well, and it's a very intimate book, and it's also about Brill's life, the family, and it takes a sharp turn towards the end when Katya, the granddaughter, comes down into his room and they begin talking.
Paul Auster, his new book is titled Man in the Dark. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Welcome back. Paul Auster is with me. We're talking about his brand new book titled Man in the Dark. He has just read for you a portion right from the beginning of the book in which the protagonist, August Brill, begins to imagine an alternate world that did not include 9/11, did not include the Iraq War, but instead images a world in which the United States is engaged in a civil war. Go on with that thought, Paul Auster. Why a civil war?
Well, I think, as we all know, this is a very divided country, and it has been now for a generation or so. And I've felt increasingly that the two sides in this country have greater and greater difficulty communicating. It's as if we're speaking two different languages. We're talking right past each other. And if you look ever at the talking head shows on television, people scream now. There used to be a kind of civility of discourse about politics, even when we disagreed. But now people don't want to hear what the other side is thinking. They don't want to even enter into a possible other logic about the world. And I think it's hurting us. It's tearing us apart. And it's not very difficult for someone like myself is living in his daydreams and imagination all the time, to just take it a little farther, take it another step, and imagine a real conflict, a physical conflict. And so this is how novels get born, I suppose, out of looking at the world and then shifting it a few degrees in one direction or another, and then a story starts to spark out of all that.
And of course, this becomes rather circular or maze-like, because at a certain point, it seems as though Brill may have something of a death wish, because it is the storyteller that the man in the hole must assassinate.
Exactly. And I think that's why I said earlier that this story is not just a thing that Brill is making up to pass the time, but a representation of his state of mind. And he begins the story in one way, and then he begins to implicate himself in the story. And he is the creator of the story, and he's created a character whose mission is to kill the creator. Of course, what he's done is checkmate himself. He's pushed himself into a corner. And even all this is taking place on the level of the imagination, he reaches a point where he doesn't know what to do. He can't really end it, except in some abrupt way, which I won't mention now.
Tell us about Katya and her relationship to August Brill. It would seem she is his true connection to both reality and another world.
Well, Katya is 23. August is 72. She's his only grandchild. She's been through a terrible business. Her boyfriend, Titus, has been killed. We learn how towards the end of the book. And these are in ways that I think we all will immediately recognize and understand. There's a connection. They're very close. As he says, they're kind of the walking wounded living together. And they're propping each other up. And so there is a part of the book towards the end in which they have a very long conversation. And it's a very intimate conversation. She mostly wants to know about her grandmother and his marriage to her grandmother. And for once, Brill opens up. And I think it's something that connects them even further by the end of the story.
Paul Auster, his new novel is titled Man in the Dark. The New Yorker magazine described your last book, Brooklyn Follies, in this way, and I'm quoting here. After a sad and ridiculous life in the suburbs, Nathan Glass retires, gets divorced, and moves to Brooklyn to die. To pass the time, he decides to write an account of mishaps and mistakes, beginning with his own, The Book of Human Folly. The tone would be light and farcical throughout, he says, and my only purpose was to keep myself entertained. It would seem that the men in your novels are really getting on and looking back.
Well, I'm getting on too, and I'm not the kid I was some years ago. So you do start looking at the world from another perspective.
What is that perspective? How does it change?
Well, the perspective is, I'm 61 right now, the certainty that there's a lot more of my life behind me than in front of me. How much I have in front is impossible to know. And so it gives you a different feeling about what everyday life is and what happens when you wake up in the morning, how precious it is. I think it becomes an absolutely overwhelming experience to realize that you're still alive.
Have you suffered?
Suffered in physically, you mean, or mentally? Of course. Well, we all have. And I think one of the things that happens to us once we hit a certain age, and for me it was around the age of 50, when I realized that more than half the people I'd ever loved in my life were dead. And you get this feeling after a while that you're walking around with ghosts inside you. You're talking to them, you're listening to them, and they become just as real as the real people who are surrounding you in your actual existence. And I think that's what happens. 20-year-old kids know they're going to die, but they don't have a sense of urgency about it. When you get older, you do. But the Brooklyn Follies, which you mentioned, so that's a comedy. I was absolutely trying to write something almost farcical about the joys and pains of everyday life, sort of in the shadow of 9/11, just before 9/11. The new book, Man in the Dark, has a tone that's very, very different.
And very dark.
Very somber.
Very,
yes.
Very dark. Yeah. What is your daily life like?
It's very boring to recount. I wake up early, and I go downstairs. We live in a house in Brooklyn. I make myself a pot of tea, drink a glass of orange juice, drink the tea, read the newspaper, and then I leave, and I go to a little apartment in my neighborhood in Brooklyn where I write, and I'm there for most of the day. I can leave at 5 or 6, and then I go home, and my wife and I make dinner, and that's the normal routine.
Why do you go to an apartment to write?
I like getting away from the house. I like being in a place where there are no distractions whatsoever.
No telephone.
There's a telephone, but only 3 or 4 people have the number. So I know if it rings, it's important. There's no distraction there. There's no radio. There's no TV. There's nothing to do there but work. And it's better for me, I think. If I were at home, the telephone would ring. I have a fax machine. The faxes would be coming in, and I like to deal with all that later when I get home.
That's your exterior life. You talked earlier about the ghosts that are part of your interior life. Does the interior life at times get in the way of your relationship to the people around you?
Well, it probably does, but I don't think in any serious way, because I happen to live with Siri Hustvedt, who is also a writer, and we've had this ongoing conversation for the past 27-plus years about what we're doing, and I consider her my greatest friend, my greatest companion in life, and she reads everything I write, and we discuss it, and I wouldn't let anything out of the house without her approval. And it goes both ways. I read everything she writes. So I think we both understand the difficulties of living this deeply interior life.
And intensely interior life.
Yes. And then trying to balance that with living in the exterior world, which is where we all are. Well, we're still together, and we have
How
no
long?
Plans. Well, it's been almost 28 years, so I have no intention of leaving, so I hope it continues.
The characters in this book, Man in the Dark, seem to allow themselves to indulge in certain stories, but they go out of their way to avoid others.
Yes. Well, that's what Brill says right in the beginning. He has trouble sleeping, and he's still mourning his wife, who died not so terribly long ago, and thinking back over his own life. And he doesn't really want to go there, especially at night. I think during the day he can confront these things, but at night, we all know when we've been afflicted with insomnia how dark and gruesome our thoughts can become, and the places they take us are not very pleasant at all. And so he's trying to ward off this with the invention of different stories. And at one point, he does say that he's made up all kinds of different stories, some of them quite hilarious. It's not that he's only thinking about wars and civil wars, But this particular night, yes.
Here's an email from Bill in Dallas, Texas, who says there is a Rod Serling-esque quality to Mr. Oster's voice, and the subject material also has some of the brain-twisting scenery of the Twilight Zone. How does Mr. Oster feel about my being reminded of that show and Mr. Serling?
Well, I have to say that I used to watch it as a kid, and I liked it very much. I don't know if my voice sounds like Rod Serling's or not. I think once this man in Dallas reads the book, if he does, he'll understand that this book does not function in the same way as the typical Twilight Zone story, which is not to knock Twilight Zone stories. It's just something different.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And if you're wondering about the spelling of Paul Auster's last name, it is A-U-S-T-E-R, Auster. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Moncton, Maryland. Good morning, Joan. You're on the air.
Good morning. I am just so tickled to be able to ask this question.
Good.
Paul, I read Timbuktu years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I adored it.
Thank you.
I read it twice. I sobbed both times when it ended. I even wrote you, which I've never done to any other author, and you wrote me back, bless you.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I try to answer my mail.
Well, you did. I loaned the book to a friend, and she lost the card that you wrote me. But anyway,
oh dear.
The book lives on my doggy. Remembrance shelves with their ashes.
Oh.
Because I loved it so much. Where in the world did that concept come from? And wasn't that really rough to sell to a publisher since it was written out of a dog's mind?
Well, I don't know where it came from. I think what I was trying to do was to write a love story. And as you know, you obviously are a dog person. Dogs love in a very unambiguous way, very directly. And I've always loved that way myself. And yet, most human beings don't. It's much more complicated, ironical, conflicted. And so I thought by expressing these emotions through a four-legged creature rather than a two-legged creature, I might be able to get closer to what I was trying to express. As far as selling it to a publisher, I had no problem. I mean, I've published so many books, and my regular publisher got the manuscript and said, fine, we like this new book, and we're going to publish it.
But wait a minute. I want to go back to your notion of unambiguous love on the part of dogs and perhaps not on the part of human beings. How do you define unambiguous love? How does that demonstrate itself? How does a human being demonstrate? How do you demonstrate unambiguous love as opposed to or in contrast to the rest of us?
Well, let me put it this way. I feel that way, and yet because life is so complicated between and among human beings, it doesn't always work out that way. And of course, there are conflicts, even with people you love deeply. It's inevitable. But with dogs and humans, it doesn't seem to work that way. And so I think that I felt as if I were Mr. Bones. I feel that I am that dog somehow. And even though he's not human, he's not quite a dog either. He's a character in a novel with four legs stuck in a dog's body. But he can think. And as far as I know, dogs can't think in the way that human beings can. So you have to take it as a kind of parable also.
You know, I recently interviewed the author of the story of Edgar Sawtelle, in which he devotes 12 pages to a dog who is thinking and calculating. And listeners called in specifically about those 12 pages mm-hmm. because they were so taken aback by the notion of a dog thinking in ways that we can understand and interpret. For me, there's no doubt.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
I really do believe that. I think dogs think and feel and perform and love in ways that are just absolutely fabulous. Paul Auster, best-selling author of The Brooklyn Follies, The Book of Illusions, City of Glass, and now Man in the Dark. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our week of interviews about presidential history and politics continues. We'll hear from press secretaries representing each president from Ronald Reagan through George W. Bush, and they'll talk about some of the tough spots they've been in. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And we're back with novelist, writer Paul Auster. His newest book is titled Man in the Dark. You might also be interested in the fact that he edited the NPR National Story Project anthology, I Thought My Father Was God. Tell us what that meant to you.
Doing that project, mm-hmm. it was one of the most thrilling things I've ever done. Probably many of your listeners remember it was in 1999 and 2000. And I had been interviewed on All Things Considered for Timbuktu, I think it was, at the time, which was coming out. And the host of the show said something to me about, he liked the way I read on the air. That was it. And he said, would you like to join the show? And I said, well, what do you, this is after the broadcast was over.
Sure, sure. And was I that said, Robert Siegel?
No, it was Daniel Zwerdling.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, what do you mean, join the show? He said, I don't know. Maybe you can come on and tell stories every once in a while. And I said, well, I'll go home and think about it. And to tell you the truth, I had no interest in doing that. At dinner that night, I told my wife, Siri, about this proposal. And it was her idea. She said, look, you don't have to sit around writing stories for NPR. Why don't you get listeners to write in their own stories? And if you get enough good stuff, then it could be something extremely fascinating. And that was the birth of the idea, the National Story Project. Let people write true stories about their own lives. And so for a year, I did it, and we had a monthly broadcast. I think I received something like 4,000 or 5,000 stories. I read every one myself. I didn't want anyone screening the material. And each month I made a program in which I was able to either summarize or read from 5 or 6 of the stories. I had about 18 or 20 minutes. There were so many good ones. About 6 months into this year, I said to myself, we need to make a book because we'll never get them all on the radio. And so that's how the anthology was born, out of the excess of good material that was coming in.
Why that title?
Because one of the stories has that title. And it was one of the funniest stories in the book.
Do you remember it?
Oh, absolutely, vividly. It was written by a man named Robert Winnie, who lives in Idaho. And as a little boy, and he, in World War II, he lived in Oakland, California. And he tells an amazing story about how he and his friends had a very mean neighbor next door, Mr. Bernheiser. And the man was always yelling at the children and scolding them for one thing or another. And Winnie's father was a tugboat captain. And unexpectedly, he came home in the middle of the day. And Mr. Bernheiser was in the middle of one of his tirades against the children. And the tugboat captain looked at the neighbor and he said, Mr. Bernheiser, why don't you just drop dead? And at that moment, Mr. Bernheiser clutched his chest, turned purple, gray, crumpled down to the ground, and was dead. And the next sentence in the story was, I thought my father was God. So it's so amazing and wonderful. So I thought this has to be the title of the book.
So you stopped that project after a year.
Yeah. I couldn't keep going. It was so much work. But I wanted to give it the year, and I'm glad I did. It was a great experience.
Here is an email about, wait a minute, where is it? I am looking. Yes, here it is, from Stephanie in Baltimore, Maryland, who says, I come from Mr. Oster's generation, probably the last that grew up using manual typewriters in school and college. I've read Mr. Oster is one of those writers who still uses a manual typewriter. Actually, I think there are paintings of him using his typewriter. Could he talk about his Olympia SM9 and where and when he got it, if he still uses it, and if so, whether he types successive drafts on it or uses it only for first drafts?
Well, okay. I still use my manual typewriter. I don't compose on the typewriter. I write everything by hand. And every day at the end of the workday, I type up on my manual typewriter what I've done. I came upon this typewriter in 1974. So this is a long time ago now. I had been living in Europe for a number of years, and at that time owned a little Hermes typewriter. It was the lightest, smallest typewriter on the market. And when I came home to New York after my years in Europe, I packed Hermes in my suitcase. And it was smashed in transit. It just completely mangled and destroyed. So I had no typewriter. A couple of days later, I went to have dinner with an old college friend. And I told him about what had happened to my typewriter. He said, well, you know, I have this Olympia that I was given as a graduation present from junior high school. About 1961. And if you want it, I'll give it to you for, you know, $40 I paid for this typewriter. And I've been using it ever since. And it has never broken. It's in perfect shape.
Paul, why?
Because I like it. I'm used to it. And I know how to use a computer. I was taught how to do it. And I don't like the feel of the keyboard. There's no resistance. And by pounding on that manual typewriter, I'm building up the muscles in my hands rather than letting them atrophy. And everyone working on computers seems to have trouble with their fingers and hands.
after a while.
Yeah.
It does happen.
Yeah.
Let's go to Karen in Houston, Texas. Good morning to you, Karen. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot. I'm always so sympathetic to Mr. Oster's musings about the lack of conversation or the art of conversation for progression in our existence generally. And I'm wondering whether he might muse upon the idea of there being a world civil war going on. There's quite a dichotomy between, seems to me, in many countries, a yearning for personal spirituality that creates calm and peace versus a stronger theme of maybe domination and power and a need for safety. And quite frankly, I'm very sympathetic to his whole idea of where are we going? Is there any consensual reality? Like many Americans, I've been brought up on the idea of there being a progressive aspect to civilization, but increasingly I'm really worried about the darkness of a reality that doesn't even entertain the possibility of diplomacy for peace.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you've just encapsulated in about 12 seconds the entire history of humanity. We've been at war with one another since the beginning, and power, conquest, murders, wars. I mean, this is the history of human beings. At the same time, we all want something else, or most of us do, and this is the great battle. I mean, how to achieve some kind of cooperation, understanding, and a quest for peace, as opposed to the ones who want to conquer. And I don't think I've ever believed in progress. We go up and down. We have our good moments and we have our bad moments. Civilizations die, new civilizations come into being, and it feels as if we're in some enormous transitional moment now in the world, and it's impossible to predict how things are going to turn out.
Thanks for calling, Karen. Here's an email from Denise in Cheverly, Maryland, who says, I own a copy of a graphic novel adaptation of Mr. Oster's book, City of Glass. I'd be interested in hearing him speak about the experience of having his work adapted into such a different medium.
This happened back in the early 90s. One of my closest friends in New York is Art Spiegelman, the comics artist, the author of Mouse. I'm sure you're familiar with that great, great book. And Art had always been after me to do a graphic novel. And I wasn't terribly interested, to tell you the truth. His, I admire greatly, but I don't think in those terms. Back then in the early 90s, he and another man started they came up with an idea to adapt novels into graphic novel form. And he approached me and said, what about doing City of Glass? And I said, okay, that would be fine. And Art hired two other people, David Mazzucchelli, who's the artist, and Paul Karasik, who thought up the story. And my sole contribution was this. I said, you can take out as much as you like, but don't add any words that are not in the book itself. And then I remember we had a long session, the four of us, when they had a preliminary draft, and we went over it. All of us made comments, and then Karasik and Mazzucchelli finished the job. I think it's terrific. It looks like the storyboards of a very interesting film, and I'm happy it exists.
So you were satisfied?
Very much so. Good. I think they did a great job.
Here's an email from Michael, who's in Baltimore. He says, my question is that the narrator in Man in the Dark sounds as though he's creating an alternate history. Can Mr. Oster comment on how alternate histories are created by people? It seems as though we all do it. If we hadn't done this, then this would have happened.
He's completely right, and this is how the imagination works. Because every moment of our lives, it seems that we're at a fork in the road, and we go left, we go right, and therein lies the tale. But what if we had taken the other direction? And I think human beings are just obsessed with reliving the decisions they make and what the consequences were and what the alternate consequences would have been if they made the other choice.
Let's go now to Mount Airy, North Carolina. Good morning, Tom.
Yes, good morning, Diane. I listen to your show every day for both hours and half for years.
I'm glad.
I would like to make the comment, though, that for your guest to accuse George Bush of having anything to do with 9/11 is where I draw the line, and I feel like that was an uncalled statement. I don't agree with it at all.
Well, what I'm referring to is the intelligence work that had been done under the Clinton administration, and how when these reports were given to Condoleezza Rice early in the Bush administration, they ignored them. Because it seems that the FBI was getting very close to understanding what this plot was, and it seems that the divisions between the CIA, FBI, made it impossible for this information to be communicated properly, and not enough was done to investigate it. I'm not blaming George Bush personally. I'm just saying that his administration dropped the ball. Whether they could have prevented it or not, I don't know. But I think they could have done more to try.
All right. Thanks for calling, Tom. And at 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Marie in Alexandria, Virginia. You're on the air.
Hello, Diane.
Hello.
Nice to hear your voice. Paul Auster is really one of my favorite writer, and I have been reading quite a bit of his books lately. And I just finished about a month ago Travel in a Scriptorium, and I wanted to ask Paul if he could clarify the end. I actually didn't understand anything at the end. And I thought, what the heck is happening here? Because I just enjoyed it so much, and then at the end I just, oh my
didn't goodness. Get it.
Well, to make it very simple, the creator becomes the created. And
I'm sorry, I didn't catch you here.
The creator becomes the created. In other words, the man who had made up all these characters then becomes a character himself in another fiction.
I see. Not that witty, I guess.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's just this book, Travels in the Scriptorium, was largely inspired by the fact that novelists create characters who are imaginary beings. But they're going to live longer than the novelist, the real person who created them. And so then what happens to the poor man who thought them up? Well, so that was the premise of the book.
I hope that answers it, Marie.
It does. Thank you so much, Paul.
You're welcome.
And thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
And finally to Jerry in O'Fallon, Missouri. Good morning, Jerry. You're on the air.
Good morning. I don't know how this particular writer or this book has slipped under my radar, but I'll make sure to read it. I've been saying for a long time that, only half kidding, that the only future that I can see with stability in this country is to kind of separate into the red and blue states, because I really don't see much that bridges. Everyone seems to be so polarized in their ideologies and politics, and I can see where the premise of the book comes from. And also, I do agree with the author that As I think Garrison Keillor said after the inauguration in 2001, how stirring it is to see the president sworn in by the 9 people who elected him.
I forgot. That's a very funny thing.
Do you have hope?
Do I have hope?
Mm-hmm.
I have to, the gap. I have to have hope. I have to. But whether this hope is grounded in any kind of reality, I don't know. But I have to have hope. We all have to have hope. And I think we can pull ourselves together. It's possible. But time is running out.
I think we have to start by listening more carefully.
Well, I agree with you about that. I certainly do. And we have to stop shouting at one another.
I think we sort of attempt to block out that which we do not wish to hear, just as your protagonist, August Brill, turns to stories he's more comfortable telling than those he's not. A wonderful book, Paul Auster.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you so much for being here. Paul Auster, his new book is titled Man in the Dark. He is, of course, the best-selling author of The Brooklyn Follies, The Book of Illusions, City of Glass. He also edited the NPR National Short Story Project anthology, I Thought My Father Was God. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Emily Robichaud answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.